there, everybody. It is Thursday, October 31st, 2013, and you are listening to this show, It's So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. We use it every now and then, but of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you, as always, this week. We're going to talk a ton about HIV and AIDS and what is going on today. And we will be welcoming, in the second half of the show, our old buddy Jack McEnroth. He will be back. But first, I must introduce to you our first guest. Dr. Gary Blick is an internationally renowned HIV and AIDS clinician, clinical researcher, lecturer, humanitarian. He has provided medical treatment to thousands and thousands of individuals with HIV and AIDS and has been the principal investigator in over 110 clinical research trials designed to benefit people with HIV and AIDS and chronic hepatitis C infection. Dr. Blick has authored or co-authored more than 155 medical manuscripts and scientific presentations regarding therapies and treatments for those with HIV and AIDS, and has been published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases, the Journal of AIDS, Journal of the American Medical Association, and many other renowned peer-reviewed medical journals. He co-founded the Global Health Organization in January 2001 to send U.S. HIV and AIDS specialists to sub-Saharan Africa and supply antiretroviral medications to those dying from HIV and AIDS. He then went on to co-found the 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit World Health Clinicians, Inc., with a mission of preventing the spread of HIV and AIDS and sexually transmitted infections and reducing the associated morbidity and mortality in the developed and developing world through treatment, patient advocacy, and assistance and education. He's got so much else going on, but if I keep going, we won't have any time to chat. So I will just say, Dr. Blick, welcome to the show. It's so gay.
Hi, Ken. Jeez, Kenny, I didn't know I did all that stuff. You know, I didn't know if you were reading about me or somebody else out there.
And sir, I cut a lot out.
I'm glad you did, Ken. But thank you for having me on, Ken.
So much to chat about. Are you ready, Doctor?
I'm ready for you.
So the way the story goes, or the way that I read it online, was, let's take us back to 1981. You're at the University of Miami Medical School. Actually, let's go back before that. Why even go to medical school? What led you down the path of saying, I want to be a doctor?
You know, actually, Ken, I was actually planning to go to veterinary school. I always had this love of animals and decided I wanted to do that. And, you know, when you sit down and you finally make your applications, you know, maybe it's because I got a Jewish mother, Ken. It could certainly be that. But I really made the decision that I wanted to go out and really help, you know, humans as opposed to animals at that point. So I initially made a decision to go to medical school to do actually plastic surgery.
Nice. And, of course, we pause at this moment because I'm sure my mom's listening and thinking, I'm a Jewish mother. Why didn't he go to medical school? So thanks for that, Dr. Blick. It's really what I need right now. All right. So you're thinking, I'm going to do plastic surgery. You're at the University of Miami Medical School. And then some reports started coming out in 1981.
Yeah, actually, I did my medical school training 80 through 84, Ken. And as you probably recall, the first cases reported to the Center for Disease Control about, you know, gay men, homosexual men, first getting that unusual pneumonia called PCP, or pneumocystis pneumonia. That report came out in June of 1981 when I was in my second year of medical school. And then later that year, we heard about, you know, gay men getting Kaposi sarcoma, what they called the gay cancer back in those years. So I started visiting the floors at Jackson Memorial Hospital at the University of Miami, started seeing, you know, my own brethren there, because I had just come out of the closet in 1979 myself, and started realizing that maybe this was more of my direction that I needed to take. I still was thinking plastic surgery, Ken, until probably when I got to 1983. That's the years when the third year of medical school, when you do what we call the rotation, mm-hmm. and you spend like 12 weeks in surgery. So I did my surgery rotation, and these surgeons were throwing scalpels across the operating room, degrading all the clinical staff, the nurses. You know, I was a medical student, so I was a little peon having to stand in the back of the room, and I realized if I was going to do plastic surgery, Ken, I'd have to go through 5 years of general surgery with these guys just to do my 2 years of plastics, and I said I would be eaten alive in these programs, and I said, not for me.
Not for you.
So I really made the decision then that I wanted to go into medicine. We certainly didn't even know this was even a virus at that time, so I decided just to take the medicine route, and that's how I went on through medical school. We still didn't know anything much about HIV, but we certainly were seeing a lot of not only gay men coming in, you know, with these unusual opportunistic infections associated with what probably became known as AIDS, but I was seeing a lot of Haitians, too.
Mm.
Remember, University of Miami is right there by the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah.
So do you remember those days, Ken? We first used to call this gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome, or GRIDS. And that was the first thing. They were blaming it all on us. And I remember my mentor at the University of Miami, Dr. Margaret Fischel, she said, and this is one of the first papers that came out, Ken, she said to get whatever was going around, you needed to have over 750 contacts per year. And I went, "Phew, that's not me. I only had 150 contacts in 1983, so that wouldn't be me."
Right.
And then, as you know, maybe your viewers don't know this, but then it became known as the 4-H Club. So whatever was going around was affecting people with homosexuals, Haitians, hemophiliacs, and heroin or intravenous drug users. That was the 4-H Club.
Wow.
And time went on. In 1984 is when I sort of graduated medical school, when we already realized that this was a virus. You know, we became known as human immunodeficiency virus. Certainly the rest is history from HIV there on. But that's how I got into HIV.
Well, we'll talk about the medical piece in a second, but describe to us, you know, a few weeks ago we had one of the co-founders of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence on the show, and we talked about just being in San Francisco in 1982, 1983, and what that was like. So obviously, you're in the middle of medical school, so you have that kind of lens on, but you're in these wards. How would you describe to, in particular, some of our younger listeners who really only know this through books or through accounts, how would you describe that experience for you of what you saw in the wards?
Yeah, it was horrific in those days, Ken, because, you know, really, remember, we didn't even know this was a virus. We didn't know what we could do for it. And pretty much everybody that got infected with HIV was facing death, the ultimate death at that point.
Yeah.
And this still goes on. Like, yeah, we'll talk later on. I work in Africa, but in Zimbabwe, and they're still facing the same kind of crisis there that we were facing in the 1980s. You know, you go onto the floors, you know, you'd see one floor, which is all full of isolation, all full of gay men and Haitians and some hemophiliacs, and there really wasn't much we could do in 1983 and 1984 to help them out. It wasn't until 1987 when we got the first drugs. You know, I encourage all of your viewers to find, you know, be it on Netflix or wherever, find the documentary How to Survive a Plague.
Yeah.
You know, our young viewers need to see this. They need to know the history of what we've gone through. They need to know the roots of, you know, certainly our activist community, ACT UP, and all these groups that came, and they changed the entire world by changing our Food and Drug Administration and the National Institute of Health. They changed how research is done in the United States, and you know, younger viewers now probably would take it for granted that drugs get approved the way they do right now. But back then, Ken, it took a decade for drugs to come to the market. Now it takes anywhere from like 3 to 5 years.
Right.
So they cut the time in half, you know, and even more than that. And that's why we have like almost 32 drugs on the market. But they do need to know that people are still dying from HIV and AIDS. We still lose about 7,000 people a year from that. And key on this, Ken, is we're still seeing 50,000 people a year getting infected, no matter what is being done to prevent this. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as the show goes on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I talk to some of our younger listeners or my students, you know, I'm a college professor, so I interact with students quite a bit, and you can use the word decimation, and they just, it's almost like they roll their eyes, because I don't think they really believe what happened to a huge swath of the community.
Yeah. Ken, it's really sad to say, but, you know, I came out of the closet in 1979, sort of during the heydays, you know, and you know, sort of danced through all those days myself, and I didn't even start practicing safer sex until, I remember, it was April 16th, 1984. I just had, you know, I had a partner at that time for about, you know, and we were together 16 and a half years, but we just had sex with another guy, a Cuban male from down in Miami, and I had actually been bleeding at that time after we had sex, and that was sort of my awakening. Didn't know it was a virus, but we started practicing safer sex at that point. Didn't have any clue what was going on at this point, except that something was happening, and then we realized, obviously, this was a virus. So they just didn't have that perspective to know that, for myself, I lost every single person in my life that was my gay friend or acquaintance, except for 3 people in my entire life. That's all I have left from those years.
Wow.
Every single other person I had associated with, I, you know, had as a friend, I had sex with, or whatever it was, they're all gone, dead, and buried, including my partner of 16 and a half years. He tested positive in 1988. Fortunately, I never got the virus myself, and when we tested, I was negative, he was positive. But he made it 16 and a half years, and he finally died up here in Connecticut with my current partner and I after fighting this for about 16 and a half years.
Wow. All right. So then we have the medical lens. Obviously, it's there's a personal piece, and there's a personal piece that drives this forward. The medical piece, and this is where we have to be very careful, Dr. Blick, because although I watched ER for 11 years and firmly believe that there are procedures I can actually do just from watching that show, which is dangerous for anyone coughing around me, I will acknowledge that I do not actually have a medical degree. So we have to translate this into layman's terms for folks. How do you go about, I said in the opening, just how much work medically you've done to research and to wrap your mind around, well, how do we move forward? How does your brain work to advance how we care for people with HIV and AIDS?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really loaded question, because this has really evolved over all the years of taking care of people. Remember, Ken, from probably, I started practicing in 1987, okay, right until 1996, we did have one drug approved in 87. We had a couple of drugs approved in the early 90s, but we started off by just treating people with one drug at a time. Remember that drug, AZT?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, we were using 15 capsules at a time. We realized that was toxic doses. People actually died from toxicity from it. And now we realize we only need to use not 1,500 but 600 milligrams a day. Well, we were treating with one drug. Then when we had some more, we treated with two drugs at a time. Still not effective, still not very efficient. Two drugs better than one. But it was really 9 years after the first drug was approved, Ken, that we learned to treat patients with what we now call cocktails, or three-drug combinations. So that we call highly active antiretroviral therapy, HAART, or HART. So that's the term we use now. And from 1996, even though those drugs were terrible back in those years, and we had people taking like 35, 40 capsules and tablets of drugs a day, we finally turned things around by doing three-drug combinations. And as you know, we went from 35, 40 capsules a day. A person, if they turn HIV positive now, Ken, they could be taking one tablet a day. And that has all three drugs in that one tablet. So we've come a really long way since 1996 when we discovered that we needed three drugs in the combination. But we still realize there's a big problem, Ken. We have a very, very big, big statistic out there that I think all your viewers need to know. We learned early last year that if you're positive and your partner is negative, this is a huge international clinical trial that told us this, if you're on medications versus not, okay? The people that are not on medications when they're HIV positive, they will transmit this virus to their negative partners, at least in the study, 27 times in 850 couples. If they were on medications, only one partner transmitted the virus to their partner that was HIV negative out of those 850 couples that were on therapy. So we basically say now, Ken, that if you're HIV positive and you're linked to care and in therapy and you take your medications and you get your virus where we can't detect it on blood tests, what we call an undetectable viral load, the chance of transmitting it to your negative partner has been reduced by 96%.
Wow.
Better than any condom, Ken. Three-drug cocktails work better than any condom. You know what the problem is, though? We have a million people known HIV positive in the United States. Every single one of them has access to therapy in the United States. Every single one, whether you're poor, whether you're rich, whatever insurance or not you have, you can still get HIV drugs in this country. So what percentage of people do you think, of those million people, what percent do you think are actually taking drugs, have their virus undetectable, and have reduced the transmission by 96% to other partners? What do you think?
I say it's low.
Yeah, it is low. It's less than 30%.
Oh, I was kind of hoping it would be more.
No, it's 28%.
Okay.
That means of the million people, still 720,000 people know they're positive and do not have their viruses under control, either because they've fallen out of care or they're not taking their medications. That happens a lot, Ken. Don't take it for granted. Just because we know how to treat this virus, they take their medications and they get the virus undetectable. Only 28% of people in this country who know they're positive are undetectable. That's a sin. That means we've really lost the education somewhere along the line. But I'm really concerned about the 250,000 people that don't know they're HIV positive.
Right.
Because of those 250,000, Ken, this is alarming to me. 13 to 34-year-olds, okay, account for over 90% of those individuals who do not know they're HIV positive, not yet been tested. And of those 13 to 34-year-olds, almost the, you know, more than a majority of them are young, gay men who have sex with men. And unfortunately, you know, we've got to get to the youth to really get them tested again to take this seriously. Because, on one side, you know, right now they're unknowingly transmitting it to their other partners by
right.
having unsafe sex. That's an alarming statistic to me. And that's why we created our program, HIV Equal, is to reduce the stigma of getting tested for HIV so we can get the youth in there and get them tested, get them linked to care, get them on therapy, get the virus under control, and make it so they can't transmit the virus to their partners, too.
Are we allowed to get angry? Because, I don't know, sometimes I hear these stats, and I'm like, oh, gosh, what the hell? Why aren't people getting tested? And, yes, let's create campaigns, and we're going to talk about it. You guys have a great campaign going on to reduce the stigma, and Jack's going to talk about it a ton as well. But then there's this part of me that's like, all right, guys, especially with Aura Quick testing and knowing that you can just go somewhere and get tested really quickly. And I get that maybe the sense of urgency, which undergirds so many different change processes, may not be felt by some of our younger men who have sex with men, but there's this part of me that just kind of is angry of like, okay, where is that ideal world where we could be doing so much more if people just got tested?
Right. Yeah. Ken, you certainly have a right to feel angry about this. And I sort of see it as a call to action at this point.
Right.
And let's be real. You know, we turned this thing around in 1996. So if you were 12 years old in 1996, you're 29 now. And you never experienced any of that death and dying that we went through, that our community went through.
Right.
And you may think that HIV is no big deal anymore because that's when it went off the front pages.
Right.
When all that major death and dying stopped, Ken, we never saw another front page article. I'll be honest with you. Newsweek used to have like a cover article, I think it was like 5 to 6 times a year, right through 1996. And once 1996 happened and we got the 3-drug combinations, I remember the article cover. It said December 12, 1996. The cover title was "The End of AIDS."
Wow.
And guess what? There was not another cover article until we hit the 10th anniversary and the 20th anniversary and the 30th anniversary. It went off the front pages.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can be angry, but I don't think our youth really has gotten the education they need. We assume that they did, but they really haven't. So we really have to go back to where we were back in the 1980s and start educating all over again. And that's really what we're trying to do through World Health Clinicians, and that's part of what HIV Equal is all about. It's not just a matter of getting youth in to get them tested and get them over the stigma of getting tested. We're trying to educate.
Yeah.
The simple thing is education is empowerment, and if we can empower our youth to take control of this, we really do have the opportunity to get this thing under control. So I don't feel angry over the fact. I feel, you know, very disheartened over the fact that, you know, our youth are going positive at 20 years old, and it's really sad to see this, but I really see this as a call to action, Ken. It's really why we're doing what we're doing right now, and pretty much I've lived my life doing this. You asked a little bit about the research. I've been researching since 1990. We actually right now are working on therapies that could potentially cure HIV. We actually presented in a medical meeting the first what we call functional cures, where we used a gene therapy, got the people off their HIV medications after genetically modifying their T cells, the cells that the virus infects. And then we take them off their medications after we give them anywhere from 5 to 15 billion cloned T cells of their own. And so far it's working in the first few people we've tried it with. But, you know, we're still a long way from that. And you can't get on to the potential of a gene therapy unless you know you're HIV positive and get tested.
Right.
So it all comes back to that. You know, I've looked at, you know, well over 110 research protocols, come up with a lot of these drugs we've been doing, but you still have to know you're HIV positive to be empowered to do something about it.
Right.
Without that knowledge, you're unknowingly infecting others, and you really can't take care of yourself unless you really get yourself tested.
Well, let's bring in a global perspective. I've said this before on the show. One of the most jarring, eye-opening experiences of my life was going out to California, doing the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride, and seeing that type of HIV, flying back to Bradley International Airport, hanging out for a few hours, and then going straight with about 60 hours between the two, going straight to Uganda for 10, 12 days. It was like two different diseases.
Yeah. Yeah, true. I certainly know what you're talking about there. And listen, Ken, we back in the early days, it was no problem going into the high schools and the junior high schools and doing education. But once things came under control, we weren't allowed back in the schools anymore. They didn't want us talking about sex in high school.
Right.
Like, you know, teenagers in high school don't have sex. We don't want to encourage them to have sex by talking about it. And then condoms? Why, you can't talk about condoms. Ken, even in the most Catholic countries in Africa, there are billboards with condoms on them.
Exactly.
Encouraging condoms. And we can't even in like the Westport school system here in Connecticut talk about condoms and sex in the school system.
Right.
This we have to change. We have to change the situation, because if we can't educate our youth, they're unknowingly going to be at risk.
Right.
They're not getting that kind of education in school to know that HIV is a deadly disease still if you don't get diagnosed and treated.
Yeah, the one school in Uganda where I volunteered quite a bit, there are signs up all over the school, and this is the equivalent of kindergarten through sixth grade, signs up everywhere that say, practice safe sex, do not trade sex for gifts, know your HIV status. And this is kindergarten through sixth. Talk to us. You've had such extensive experiences, and I'm almost hesitant to ask you about your experiences in Africa, because I don't want this to come across as trite, because you could, I'm sure, and I would love to hear it for hours and hours, but how would you even begin to describe what you've seen abroad back to our American listeners?
Oh, boy, Ken. So, you know, think about the year 2000, the first time I went to Africa, Ken. Well, we had things under control in the United States. We had better and better drugs. We knew people really didn't have to die from it. Although we were still losing 7,000 to 10,000 a year.
Right.
So I went over to Botswana for the first time, because our International AIDS Conference was in South Africa. I figured I'd never get a chance to go back. Let me go on safari. Let me see this country. I went into one of the female wards in the hospital in the capital of Botswana, in Gaborone, and I saw 137 women, all essentially comatose or moaning incoherently, ready to die and be cremated, many of them nameless. So I saw the crisis all over again. I saw 1983 medical school at the University of Miami. I saw that again in the year 2000 in Botswana.
Wow.
Now, Botswana has really turned things around, because they are one of the wealthiest countries there in Africa, on the African continent, because of the diamond mines and everything, and because it's a democratic country, they've turned things around. But the bottom line is, I'm in Zimbabwe right now. And in Zimbabwe, there's 80% unemployment in Victoria Falls. That means most of these people don't have any money to even eat, no less be able to go get a doctor's appointment, get some medicines, and get treated. So we're in the heart of the epidemic, where we think it actually started well over 100 years ago in sub-Saharan Africa, in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, where we expect somewhere between 30 to 35% of the people we're going to be testing and treating are HIV positive, Ken. Can you imagine one-third of the population is going to be infected? And there's over 1.2 million orphan children in Zimbabwe, orphaned by losing their parents to HIV and AIDS, most of these kids being HIV positive themselves. It's devastating. It's heart-rendering. I can I just encourage people, if they ever get the opportunity, to go over and see the beauty of Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe, one of the seven natural wonders of the world, and then leave the falls and go drive into the townships and see the distinction between, you know, beauty and the devastation. It's still happening there right in front of our eyes, you know?
The orphan piece is just mind-boggling, and it's just one of those things where I just remember thinking and meeting just scores and scores of orphans and thinking, well, maybe someone's parents died in a car accident, but no, none of them did. They really all died due to complications of AIDS.
It's true, Ken. And I'm not trying to plug anything here, but, you know, if your viewers go onto Facebook, you know, / Beat AIDS Project Zimbabwe, and we also have Beat AIDS Project Zimbabwe.org, they can really see, you know, some of the faces that we're talking about here, Ken. They really can get to experience a lot of the work we're doing there. And we just actually identified our clinic property this year, and we just bought ourselves the first 4x4 vehicles so we can go into the bush where people have no electricity and water, so we can access those people. But our goal eventually is to fly teams of Americans over there to help out. We want doctors and nurses and social workers, and we want patients. We want anybody that will come over and volunteer with us to get the whole African experience to help us out with this Beat AIDS Project Zimbabwe. That's our eventual goal.
Dr. Blick, I don't know what show you think you're on, but this show, you get to plug things. That's totally fine.
Thank you.
Totally fine. Now, with our just a few minutes left, what do people need to know about World Health Clinicians?
World Health Clinicians is obviously a nonprofit, Ken. You know, I realized that this was the only way to go if we were going to help out in Africa. And then I also realized, you know, to survive the healthcare crisis in the United States, you know, I needed to take my private practice, my for-profit practice, and put it under a nonprofit roof. And what that has really done for us, Ken, it's allowed us to do all of these kind of programs. So worldhealthclinicians.org is a place people can go on to learn about all the things we're doing. We've actually just launched a website. There'll be plenty of education out there. There'll be ways for people to outreach into our projects. Our nonprofit clinic in Norwalk, Connecticut, where we're working out of, is called Circle Care Center. They'll learn a little bit about that. All of these are on Facebook also, if they want to check these things out. And the key is it'll link them all to the most exciting campaign that I think Jack will talk to you about later on, called HIV Equal. You know, it's just like the No Hate campaign. It's a photographic campaign, you know, to try to get people aware that there's stigma about HIV testing and help overcome it. Jack will tell you all about what we've come together. I'm so happy that we hired Jack, and I finally got to meet him and brought him on as our Director of Public Relations and our events coordinator and everything. But this is a really exciting campaign that we take, you know, around the nation. I hate to use the term, but we think it's really going to go viral, Ken.
Nice.
You know I have to use it at that point. But it's become so popular. Jack will tell you we held our first, you know, the launch of the HIV Equal campaign at the center this weekend. We were hoping to test 50 to 75 people during the 5-hour event that we threw there. Ken, we were overwhelmed. 260 people came to the event.
Oh, amazing.
We tested over 125 people in 5 hours. We even had Senator, you know, Dick Blumenthal, you know, our Connecticut senator in the U.S. Senate come. We had our congressman from our area, who's also in the U.S. Congress, Jim Himes, come. Our local Senator Bob Duff came. I have the money picture, Ken. I have the picture of all three of them swabbing them inside of their mouths with that 20-minute OraSure test, to find out they were all HIV negative.
Nice.
It was just an amazing event to see, you know, all these youth come out, you know, for this. And we made it sort of like a party. We tried to take the darkness out of HIV testing, the darkness and the stigma away. We made it into a party with a DJ. We had a drag queen doing some entertainment. Everybody came, and we tested over 125 people. It was overwhelming, Ken. So I know we're going to be taking this to, you know, to your viewers. We'd like to get all around New England, and we'll probably take this elsewhere around the country too. And I'm sure Jack will give you a lot more information about HIV Equal.
Speaking of, do you want to do a performance evaluation on the air of Jack? Is there any advice we can give him to do his job better? What critiques can we offer him from your perspective?
You know, I certainly knew Jack from the Project Runway days, but, you know, when we were doing our ribbon-cutting ceremony to open up our center, you know, I thought it was a great opportunity for him to come up. You know, I'll let Jack tell you all about himself, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers already know, obviously, that he's gay, but he's also HIV positive. So he can talk from the perspective of being a youth beginning HIV when he was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And I think your viewers really need to hear that viewpoint. It hasn't been, a wonderland for Jack over the last, 24 years being HIV positive, but he is live. He's here to talk about it. You know, you won't be able to see him on the radio show, but he looks great. The key is he speaks to the way people understand him to speak. Just encourage Jack to keep going with what he's doing. He's running great events now. He's doing great public relations with social media, which is what we need to get out to the 18 to 34-year-old, youth group, and just encourage him to keep up what we're doing right now because he's doing such a magnificent job. Also, along with our celebrity photographer, Thomas Evans, who does an incredible job of this photographic campaign. The two of them, really, I got to give them the credit. They came up with this HIV Equal concept. Even though I've always been talking about getting out to youth, they took the idea, ran with it, developed a brilliant, brilliant campaign here. So I just have to applaud, Jack and Tom for being, incredible in their innovativeness and, their ingenuity in how they came up with this campaign.
So what I hear you saying is you would like Jack to wear a shirt more.
Actually, when we go out during the summertime, he can take that shirt
there
off.
There you go.
As far as I'm concerned, I'll stand right alongside of him. At 57 years old, I have no problem doing that myself, Ken.
Bringing it back to a focus, tell everyone how they can learn more about World Health Clinicians.
Yeah, so very easily, we have our website, worldhealthclinicians.org. You can certainly look at our projects. We have websites now also for circlecarecenter.org, as well as beataidsproject.org, as well as hivequal.org. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. They can find those names wherever they look at this point. And really, we encourage feedback. So take a look at our sites. take a look at what we're doing. Please give us some feedback. Let us know if you want to get involved with us, and let us know if we're doing anything wrong and you have any suggestions on how we can do things better. We're certainly open to any kind of criticism, positive or negative, on what we can do to help people out.
Nice. Well, Dr. Gary Blick, you are doing life-saving work. The easy thing would be to say, yes, of course, he's a doctor. He's doing life-saving work. And yes, on that side, absolutely. But then on the other side, you are providing a voice to folks who really do need a voice, for folks to get tested, for folks to know their status, for folks to be taking the medications that they need to be taking, for folks to have more of a perspective of what's going on internationally. That, too, along with the medical side, is life-saving work.
Well, thank you, Ken. I really appreciate it. And I'll just say one last note.
Please.
All the youth that came out to our event this past weekend, Ken, they were enthralled by what we were doing. They all signed up to want to volunteer with us and move along with us around the country. We are creating a sense of community again. It's just like that sense of community we had when we were dealing with people deaf and, you know, dying at that point, and we had ACT UP and all the activists around us. We came together as a community, as a gay men's community. Listen, it wasn't just gay men's community, was the GLBTQ community that came around when we were dealing with all this death and dying. We need to get that sense of community back, Ken, and I really have hope now and some optimism that this is really going to occur.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. Dr. Blick, what an honor.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you, sir.
You have a good day.
And I am all alone. There is no one here beside me, and my problems have all gone. There is no one to deride me, but you got to have me.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, as promised, we welcome back to the show Jack McEnroth. Jack is a fashion designer, a reality TV star, an HIV and AIDS activist, a competitive swimmer, a model, a calendar pinup, I saw the pictures, a spokesperson, and just a great radio friend to all of us here at This Show Is So Gay. We welcome him back for a fourth time. Jack, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. I think former needs to go before model now, because I'm getting a little long in the tooth. So, but that was a lovely introduction.
I think full of it now needs to be added to your introduction. No, you're still doing the modeling. And you know, it's so oddly, it's so funny how radio works. It's already been a year since you've last been on the show. It feels like a few weeks ago.
It does?
Or maybe not. Okay. Talk about that later.
Well, no, I know. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday, but I've had a really crazy year. So, you know, everything feels like, was that a month ago or was that 2 years ago? I'm so confused. There's so much going on, but that's just life.
Well, we have a ton to talk about. We should start with, we just got off the air with Dr. Blick. We did conduct your performance appraisal on the air. You, unfortunately, were not present for that.
Oh, great.
Sorry.
I know it was awful. I apologize in advance.
I will tell you that he has recommended that you have had a couple days off, so maybe it's time to come back to work.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Just putting that out there.
I told him afterwards, well, you know, we planned this amazing event, and I was like, don't expect to see me for 72 hours because I'm taking a bottle of Xanax and getting in my bed. Bye.
Oh, life lessons from Jack McEnroth. All right, well, we have a ton to discuss, though. I will say, I have to put this out there. I wrote on Facebook, I'm like, Jack McEnroth is going to be back on our show. Does anybody have any questions? And I quote from a listener, quote, is it true that Jack McEnroth would break out in hives if he wore a shirt in a Facebook picture?
Oh, God. Well, clearly, that person has not been on my Facebook page lately, because as I mentioned, like, I actually haven't done a clothing optional photo shoot in quite some time. So I will not break out in hives, and there's a lot of pictures. And although I have to say the interesting thing is the number of likes that you get drops exponentially when you put clothes on. So every once in a while, I do have a photo shoot out there with a photographer named George Rivas, who I keep telling him, I'm like, now that I'm in a more professional job setting, I'm like, please don't put them out there, but they'll surface at some point. So But I think I'm done, like, taking my clothes off for the camera. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll keep everyone posted.
Because it's a really good cause, like, you know, Thursday. I don't know.
Oh, Jack, one of our oldest guests in terms of how long you've been on the show. Oh, what a pleasure. All right. So here's the thing. I actually went back. I did a little. This sounds a little crazy, and I apologize in advance. I did a little Jack McEnroth immersion where I went back and listened to your past three appearances. And here's the thing. We've obviously talked about HIV and AIDS, and as I said to folks at the start of the show, that is our focus for this week's episode. But we really haven't gotten at your story, and we just kind of talked around it. So can we get at the Jack McEnroth story?
Yeah.
All right. So you grew up in Seattle.
Yeah, actually I grew up in a suburb called Bellevue, which is where all the rich people live now. But it didn't used to be like that. I was poor white trash, but
nice.
Okay, go on.
And then you went to UC Berkeley.
I did.
And what was that experience like for you?
It was interesting. I'm the oldest of three kids. I have a younger brother and sister, and my father, who was pretty much absent the whole time, he was a ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and my mother was a registered nurse, and I was supposed to go off to Berkeley and be a doctor, and I was pre-med for 2 years, and then I said, F this, and then I decided to become an art major, and I'd come out of the closet, even though it was not a surprise to very many people. And after I told my mom that, sort of all bets were off. So she was like, oh, you're not going to be a doctor? I'm like, after I told her I was gay, she was like, whatever. So I went, and then I became I double majored in fine arts and sociology. But I loved Berkeley. It was great.
Nice. And then you moved to New York in 91. And it is my understanding, if I'm putting together the facts correctly, the diagnosis came before 91.
Yeah, so sort of. So basically what happened, I'll try to give you the short version, although it'll probably run long because that's how I am.
Go for it.
I got pneumonia when I was a junior in college. So that was in 1990. AIDS was crazy in San Francisco and all that. And so I went to the doctor, but I also was partying and going through finals, and it was a nightmare. And I also had pneumonia 3 or 4 times before because I have asthma.
Mm-hmm.
So I had pneumonia. I went to the doctor. I got an HIV test. It came back negative. And I was like, well, whatever. Like, I'm sure. I mean, I had just come out. It's not like I'd slept with, not that it matters how many people you had sex with.
Right.
There weren't very many. So, you know, fast forward, I graduated from Berkeley. I moved to New York to go to Parsons School of Design. Probably 6 months into my freshman year, I get, like, ulcers down my esophagus to where the point, like, I let it go for 2 days to where I couldn't even swallow water. So I had to go to the emergency room, and again, they were like, this is really weird for someone your age to pre-presenting these symptoms. So I got another HIV test, and that's when it came back positive. But my seroconversion, I track it back to when I had pneumonia, and I didn't have any of the antibodies yet, so I was in that weird window period. So
right.
I know exactly, now when I look back on it, I know exactly who and where and how and why and all that crap.
Talk to me about, I've read so much about, look, you can be a gay man coming out, but then there's a whole separate coming out process when you are HIV positive.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think especially now, it's a very different set of issues than, you know, I found out I was HIV positive in 1990, 91-ish. So it's different because back then, I assumed I would maybe live 5 years at the most.
Wow.
So you're not so concerned with what people think about you or will think about you and the judgment as much as you are about, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to die or what's going to happen to me. And, you know, people that are your younger listeners aren't going to remember, but people often died really suddenly and really grisly. Like you see these walking corpses, and there were all these diseases that Kaposi's sarcoma,
mm-hmm.
and these cancers. There was a thing called MAC that no one gets anymore, where basically you just go blind. And I mean, all these bizarre things were happening to people. So it's like, you know, I was just more concerned about that. Now, when people find out they're HIV positive, I think people know for the most part that it's a fairly manageable chronic condition, especially if you're treated early. But the stigma is, I think it's much worse, because back in the late 80s and early 90s, I told my best friend the same day. I was like, oh my God, you know, because you kind of, I wasn't worried about what people thought of me. I was worried about, oh my God, I'm going to die. Like,
right.
that's much more pressing than whether or not if I give a shit about someone's opinion of me. So
right.
now it's a different set of issues that people, you know, are dealing with, that they worry about, you know, disclosure, what other people are going to think of them, because it's not so much about survival. You know, it is, and I don't want to make light of that being HIV is a cakewalk. I mean, it's still a pain in the butt, and, you know, there are a lot of issues, and there can be side effects with medications, and nobody likes to take medications they don't have to, and nobody knows the long-term effects of taking all these medications, because there have never been any. So,
right.
But, you know, I mean, I think the stigma is the bigger issue right now.
What about, you know, we gay men and our mothers? Talk to me about that coming out process with your mother, of telling her that you're positive.
My mom's awesome. She raised all of us. My parents got divorced when I was 8, and she raised my brother and sister and I by herself, and she's amazing. And, you know, she's a nurse, so she's no fool. And I had a boyfriend named Greg Bueller who died from AIDS in 1996.
Okay.
And I was by his bedside, and you know, I was calling my mom. Unfortunately, his parents are lovely, and I don't want to say anything negative about them, but they had some serious religious beliefs that were in conflict with Greg's quote-unquote lifestyle, and that was a hurdle. So I was by his bedside, and it was actually, you know, thankfully fairly quick. He died. He felt sick one day, and 3 weeks later, he was dead. So, but I was by his bedside every day, and I would call my mom crying, and, you know, she knew he was HIV positive. I had never said that I was, but listen, I mean, come on, you know,
right.
So she's not an idiot, but she doesn't, you don't, there's a lot, certain things you don't want to believe to be true. You know, he passed away. It was awful. You know, she was really supportive, never confronted me. Then his family lived in Los Angeles, so we had the memorial service in Los Angeles, and the day after the memorial service, I sat her down and we had the talk. And it is, like you said, it's like coming out all over again. And, you know, I think by then it was 96. The protease inhibitors were already out. She'd had a lot of AIDS patients herself. And so, and actually, turns out she had found I was taking AZT in the early days, which was a very, it was a white pill with a blue band around it, and it looked like no other pill. And she found one in my room once, and she knew what it was. But she admitted that to me later, but she just didn't want to believe it. So yeah, we had a long talk, and she said, of course, all the right things, but still freaked out on her own. And I know in retrospect, she called her sister and crying, and there was a lot of that going on. But I have been very, very fortunate and very, very lucky. And, you know, and since the initial sewer conversion, I've never been sick, ever, anything HIV related. So I've been really lucky. But she's been great. Now she's like, you know, she marches in the parades. She lives in the gay neighborhood in Seattle. She's a huge fag hag. She volunteers at Bailey House. She's amazing. So, yeah, it's a difficult conversation to have. That's the kind of the question I get from people on Facebook and whatnot all the time. Like, I really don't want to hurt my family. And,
right.
But I'm like, you know what? It's like, you need to give them the choice a little bit. That's what I always feel like. It's like, it's hard news to hear. But it's, you're hiding a secret is really awful as well. And I think people underestimate their family a lot, you know?
Yeah.
I think people are a lot more compassionate and understanding, and they feel bad, and they don't want you to have to go through something by yourself either. So yeah, she was great, and it was hard, but it's also a different time now. So I hope people can be a little bit more open with their families.
Quick programming note on next week's episode, Jack's mom.
Oh, God, you think I'm long-winded. You need to block out 4 hours for Connie McEnroe.
So I should say, on next week's episode, Jack's mom, part 1 of 5.
Part 1 of of a miniseries.
I love it. Well, look, you have been everywhere. You've done event after event. You've talked to individuals. You've talked to organizations. You've been in educational environments. You've obviously been on TV. I feel like you, Jack McEnroth, have the answer about stigma. If we gave all the power to you, which I'm happy to do for the next few minutes, what can we do to reduce this stigma? How can, as we just talked about with Dr. Blick, the sheer number of people who are not getting tested, then of course the sheer number of people who know their positive status and aren't taking medication, change it all for us, Jack. Give us some keys to, are we doing something wrong? How can we make this all better?
Well, I mean, if I had the answer to that, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But what I can say and what I do say to people is visibility is key. So first of all, getting okay with it. And even if you're just telling your friends, CDC estimates 1 out of 5 gay men or men who have sex with men in any urban city like New York, LA, San Francisco, 1 out of 5 is HIV positive. So 20% of the gay male population. And out of them, 50% don't know it. So people aren't getting tested. People aren't talking about it. People I hear all the time are like, I don't know anyone who's HIV positive. I'm like, yeah, you do. Right. They just never told you. So if people, number one, would start talking about it, that takes away some of the sting of the stigma. And then the other thing is, I know I'm sure you talked to Gary about HIV Equal, and it's about just visibility. I think one of the greatest things, my legacy will be that I outed I came out as HIV positive on national television back when Project Runway was the show.
Right.
Everyone watched it and was obsessed with it. And overnight I became like the go-to poster boy for HIV, which is great. It changed my life in a really amazing, positive, pun intended way. So I think it's just about continuing to talk about it, because what stigma is internalizing the blame and shame and believing in it and feeding into it, that there's something that you did wrong and there's a reason why you should be ashamed. And I just think we have to call bullshit on that.
Right.
And say, listen, a disease is a disease. Like, you didn't necessarily do anything wrong. I mean, it's just we all make mistakes, missteps, nobody's perfect. It doesn't matter. I mean, do you blame someone because they have cancer? Do you blame someone because they have diabetes? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So it's like, don't take ownership of the shame and the blame, and be proud of who you are in all aspects, and of your gayness, of your transgenderness, of your HIV-ness, or that's what makes you unique, and just reject the stigma.
I would imagine, and maybe we've talked about this before, so it's easy for me to imagine, I would imagine that you, Jack McEnroth, are the first person for any number of people to whom they have come out about their HIV status.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How do you wrap your mind around that? That's a lot of pressure for me to even say that out loud.
You know, the first year after Project Runway was really, it really blew my brains, because the outreach on social media, Facebook, actually, believe it or not, I set a MySpace page to give you an idea of how long ago it was. Facebook was just taking off. And yeah, every day I would get like 10 messages from around the country of people telling me. And I have, even just recently, I had someone like, he's like, I really want to take you out to dinner and talk to you about something. And I was the only person other than his doctor he'd ever told. I've had people who told me, people written me letters saying that they were going to kill themselves, and the only reason they didn't was because of me. They Googled me and found me and saw that you can live a normal life. And I mean, and so how do you deal with that and wrap your head around it? You just are grateful.
Right.
And you do what you can do. And I'm just me. I can only be, and I'm by no means perfect, and I'm not, a prophet or anything. It's great that I've had a positive influence on some people. And I I've had the opposite. I've had people say, you don't give me enough attention, and I want more from you, and I accept more from you. I'm like, I can do what I do. I can do all I can do, and that's it. And you have to get okay with that.
Right.
And just be.
Because you're an individual who needs to be healthy as well, Jack.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like, I'm just going through my life the best I can, too. And sometimes I have days where I'm like, oh, So, yeah, I mean, there's times where I'm like, oh, and I feel bad. There, you know, and I coached a lot of people through stuff, but there's only so much of me that I, you know, I mean, there's only so much I can do. And then I have to say, listen, you know, I don't know you, and I wish the best for you, and I think it's time for you to consult a professional, and I'm just giving up one person's opinion and sharing one person's experience, and that's all I can do.
Yeah. Well, you've taken on the post. You were hired to the post of Director of Public Relations and Special Events at World Health Clinicians.
Correct.
Does this represent a departure? I mean, I'm looking back over your bio, and I'm thinking, okay, this is a different type of position than you've done previously.
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting, people ask me that a lot, because people still so associate me with being a fashion designer and Project Runway, which that will never, that part of me will never go away. But reality TV is a very interesting animal, and when you go off of it, people expect that you're going to be the next Calvin Klein or the next whatever show you're on, the big star,
right?
And your future is fulfilled, and that's the end. And that's actually not really what happens. You know, you have 15 minutes of exposure, and it's sort of what you do with it that makes, you know, the future, you know, happen, whatever. So,
right.
So I realized in that moment, and disclosing my HIV status, so that was a very important moment in television, and it led my life on a totally different pathway. And then, so for 4 years after that, I was a spokesperson for Merck, and they developed this whole entire, it's Merck Pharmaceuticals, they developed this whole entire education program built around me called Living Positive by Design.
Yeah.
And I just started speaking, like doing the speaking circuit, and I would go to the US AIDS conference and different AIDS service organizations. And then that ended. And then I just kind of thought, okay, now what do I do now? Do I go back to fashion design where, let me be honest, my fashion career was working at Tommy Hilfiger, working at Levi's. Like, I sat at a cubicle and I emailed, you know, factories overseas. I didn't have this glamorous job where I was showing at Paris Fashion Week.
Right.
And doing all this amazing stuff. So, you know, maybe 5% of my job was creative and the rest of it was just work. So in the end, I was like, listen, there's so few people that speak about HIV and have a voice publicly. I really need to keep doing this. So, you know, and not to discount the activists and all the other people that are doing amazing work in HIV, but we all know that television is a crazy medium. So,
it is, yeah.
So I just, you know, I actually, the way I fell into this job is I was at World Health Clinicians doing, they recently became a nonprofit organization and completed this building that's partially a Circle Care Center. It has a pharmacy attached to it. It's also a Triangle Community Center, which, so they're trying to make it a whole LGBT center. There's Mid-Fairfield AIDS Project, which I can never say correctly. These are all housed in the same building. They're trying to make it really an LGBT go-to center for the Connecticut area. And I spoke at their ribbon-cutting ceremony, and Gary Blick was like, I'd really like to work with you in the future. Like, you know, how could we make this happen? And I was like, funny you mentioned that, because I would like to keep going in this direction, and I'm no longer working for Merck. So we you know, put our heads together and came up with, I've basically been marketing the brand of Jack McEnroth, and I managed to do it fairly successfully for 5 years.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and a lot of these reality people come and go in 10 minutes. So I'm like, I must be doing something right. So and actually working on Living Positive by Design, I garnered a lot of knowledge about public relations and branding and all this stuff. So we created a position for me, and it's been amazing.
Nice. Well, for all of those folks out there who are in their local communities who want to put on an event and raise some awareness and get people tested, any tips for how to get people to turn out for a special event?
It's interesting because I live in New York City, and we had done the event in – I don't know what Dr. Blick talked about, but we had an event on last Saturday, which was an LGBT health and wellness event, and we launched HIV Equal, which is this amazing anti-stigma testing initiative campaign that we're doing. So you can go to HIVequal.org and see all about it. We photographed Billy Porter from Kinky Boots, Peter Staley, the amazing activist, Congressman Jim Himes, tons of fabulous drag queens. Like, it's amazing. But anyway, you know, if I was doing this event in New York City, I could have 500 people there tomorrow because
right.
those are my peeps.
Right.
But Connecticut was a little, especially because I'm in Norwalk. We're based out of Norwalk. I commute like an hour and a half every morning, so say a little prayer for me. but, you know, it was a lot of social media. We did our due diligence. We found all the youth groups. I went to the Norwalk Community College and sat in on their gay lesbian Straight Gay Alliance or
nice.
Whatever the hell that was called, and you know, I just recruited, and you just make it fun. We brought a drag queen host, Titania Steele. We had a DJ, T-Boy from New York City. It was just fun. We made it fun, and it's like, you know, do you want to advertise as an HIV testing event and expect to get a lot of people there? I'm like, you kind of want to get them in the door with something fun and appealing.
Right.
And then, you know, take away some of the, because there's stigma attached to HIV testing, too. A lot of people don't want to know. On Grindr, they just came out with an informal survey that, like, 1 out of 10 Grindr users have never been tested for HIV, period, at all.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a large population that still has, there's a stigma around just getting tested for HIV or being even associated with HIV, so...
Jack, in your immersion in this work, and I my hope is that I'm not ending on such a short moment, but do you feel like things are getting better?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Let's end with a very
helpful
message. First of all, I know there's so many amazing clinical trials with gene therapy and stuff
right.
going on. So there's a mutation that a very small percentage of the population has called CCR5. And they're immune. And I think people might be familiar with Timothy Brown, who was the first person cured of AIDS or cured of HIV. And that involved a bone marrow transplant, and it's all very complicated. But basically, the technology is out there. They're doing stuff now. There's someone in our office, actually, who's in a clinical study where they took out his own white immune cells, mixed it up with the CCR5 genetic mutation, put them back in. There's a ton of amazing research going on. There's a vaccine that's now in its going into its second human trial phase, and that's very promising. So if you were to ask me if I was a betting man, it will be in the next 10 years, it'll be cured.
Wow. That would be great, Jack.
That would be amazing. And then I'll have to come work for you because I won't have a job anymore.
Yes.
So,
welcome to Cleveland, Jack.
Yes, thank you. You'll be around for the gay games?
I will be around for the gay games. We're doing an in-person interview when you get here for the gay games.
Fabulous.
Awesome.
Fabulous.
All right, well, folks can go to jackmcenroth.com to learn about Jack. But, of course, as we've heard, you must go to worldhealthclinicians.org. Jack, you know you're one of our favorites.
And for sure, go to HIVEQUAL.org and like us on Facebook. Please.
Perfect.
We're brand new, and I love you too. Thank you so much for having me, honey.
Thank you, Jack.
All right, have a good night or day or whatever time you're listening to this. Bye!
If I was beautiful like you, all the things I would do, those not so black.
Exciting news for us over here at This Show Is So Gay. We were actually nominated for one of the top 10 GLBT podcasts for the 9th annual Podcast Awards. This is, like, extraordinarily thrilling for us. We're thrilled to be in the company of the 9 other nominees. This is as close as I'm ever going to get to saying, it's an honor to be nominated, but it really is an honor to be nominated. Also, we wouldn't mind winning. Winning would be pretty cool. So you can stroll on over to podcastawards.com and vote for us. The voting starts on November 1st, and hey, throw us a vote, and maybe we can take home the trophy. That'd be pretty cool, but definitely a big honor for us, validation for all that we do, and of course, we are thrilled that you guys are listening. That's what makes this worthwhile. Get out there, go do some incredible, incredible things. Make a difference in this world by using your voice the way you know how to use it to lift up the voices of your LGBT brothers and sisters, and of course, while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?